Good morning, everybody. It turns out I have a frog in my throat to start with. It's not good. Okay. So, it's my pleasure this morning to talk to you about QCD and asymptotic freedom. QCD and asymptotic freedom represent one of the great triumphs of 20th century physics, and it is of a certain importance for you who want to look at data at the LHC or to theories at the LHC. The reason it's important is essentially, you know, if you think about building the LHC, you'd be foolish starting off without understanding Maxwell's equations, because you want to use the electromagnetic force to accelerate particles. It's the same way for the analysis of the data. If you don't understand QCD, you're going to have a hard time understanding what the data is, and you'll be unable to discover all the wonderful things you want to discover: the Higgs, extra dimensions, supersymmetry, dark matter, all that stuff. So basically, an understanding of QCD is necessary in order to understand the data at the LHC. So that's why we're doing it. The second reason we're doing it, of course, it's always fun to come back to Scotland, particularly if you're from Scotland, as I am. And we are not at all worried by the weather. We view Scotland as a great place. It's a great place to sleep here, you see, because the weather is perfect for sleeping. It's never too hot. Okay, I hope you won't do that in the lectures, though. And let me start off by telling you about the motivation for QCD. Okay, so let me just say, is there a pointer? There's not. Oh, this stick, right, thank you. Okay, so let me just say that this is the plan for the lecture this morning: motivation, Lagrange, Gauge, Invariance, Feynman rules, running coupling, the beta function of QCD, and measurements of alpha S. Together with the very illustrious Stirling and Weber, I've written a book on this, which is about 13 years old now. And it deals essentially with this matter, and it is the product of courses such as this. We wrote the book after giving a lecture such as this. So I do recommend it to you, although I should say that your job is to make the book completely obsolete. And so I want you after to go out and do that. All right, so let's start off with motivation for color SU3. So why do we believe that there's a color degree of freedom which describes the interactions in the problem? Okay, so if we consider the ratio, say, R, of E plus E minus, which is the total hadronic cross-section. So here we have an electron and a positron annihilating through a virtual photon to give you a fermion and an anti-fermion pair. Okay, so if the virtual photon, when it decays, excites all electrically charged constituents from the vacuum, FF bar, and you might imagine that those are quarks and anti-quarks, and so at low energy, this virtual photon will excite only the up, the down, and the strange quarks, each of which occurs in three colors. So for this ratio R, which is the ratio of the total hadronic cross-section to the mu plus mu minus pair cross-section, we see it will be proportional to the number of the squares of the charges multiplied by the number. Okay? So if we estimate what this ratio R is, we can see that it's going to be equal to 2/3 for the up, 2/3 squared for the up, minus 1/3 squared for the down, minus 1/3 squared for the strange. And we multiply by 3 for the number of colors. And we expect that ratio to be equal to 2. If we go slightly higher energy, above, say, 10 GeV, when we can excite also the charm and an extra bottom-type quark with a charge minus 1/3, this number will change from 2 to 11/3. So how does that look with the data? Well, it looks not so bad. So what we see here is exactly the ratio R E plus E minus, which is the ratio of E plus E minus go to hadron divided by E plus E minus go to mu pair. And so if you look at low energy, it's somewhere of the order of 2 in this region, below the region where we excite the charm quark, i.e. below 3 GeV or so. And then when we look above the charm region, it's of the order of 11/3. So you see that our prediction is carried out. Now, it's an interesting prediction because, in fact, when you look at the E plus E minus cross-section to hadrons, you're not seeing quarks at all, but you're seeing pions, kaons, and all that other stuff. But nevertheless, this simple model in terms of the production of quarks seems to describe the hadronic cross-section, and later in the lecture we'll get on to the reason for that. Okay, so that's a sort of motivation for the number of three. So we see that the number of three seems to do pretty well. Now, one of the other historical motivations for color was that the observed baryons are interpreted as three quark states. And so to account for the constituents of the baryons, they're forced to have a half integral spin in order to account for the spins of the baryons. So the baryons are observed to have spin a half, spin in three halves, and so we expect the constituents of the baryons also to have half integral spin. Okay, so for example, if we consider the delta plus plus, which is a resonance in pi in nucleon scattering, which is a mass of 1232, this thing here is subsumed to be made up of three quarks, and it has a spin of three halves. So all of these guys, the spins are pointing out. And the isospin is also equal to three halves. And so the basic state seems to be completely symmetric in spin and isospin. Now that's a pretty bad thing for a fermion to be in a symmetric state. So in order to accommodate the idea that these guys are in fact fermions, we have to introduce an extra degree of freedom, which is called the color. And the color, we put the thing in a completely anti-symmetric state with respect to color, and then we've explained why the masses of the low-mass baryons are the way they are. Okay, so you've introduced an extra color degree of freedom, and the index is has three possible values, say red, green, and blue, and which is carried by each quark. And the baryon wave function is totally anti-symmetric with respect to this new index. Very good. Okay, so you've introduced a new degree of freedom. If you have a degree of freedom, you'd expect that you'd be able to excite it. So instead of seeing just color singlet states, you expect to see excited states with octets and all sorts of other stuff, just like we did for the baryons themselves, for the flavor quantum numbers, you expect to see excited states of color. That's not the case. We don't see those. We don't observe those. And so we have to come up with some reason why we don't see them. And so the hypothesis would be that only the color singlet states can exist in nature. Okay, so why would that be plausible? So what I want to present for you now is an argument that suggests why it's plausible that you only have color singlet baryons. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at a little model of the interactions between quarks and quark and antiquark. So remember, we have our quarks. Here's a quark, and here's another quark. This guy here has some color, and so these two guys both carry color, and they can exchange a colored gluon between them. And as we'll see later, the interaction probability, just like in electrodynamics, if you exchange a photon, you expect to have E squared over R. In QCD, you expect to have lambda I, sum over I, over R squared, perhaps times the coupling constant for the strong interaction. So these lambdas here are the Gell-Mann matrices, and lambdas are the matrices of SU3. So we hypothesize that our color degree of freedom, that quarks are representations of the SU3 algebra, and the SU3 algebra is specified by lambda A, lambda B, the anticommutator equals 2i f A, B, C, lambda C. Okay? So that's the algebra which these representations of... and so it's easy to see, for example, that if you take lambda 1, if you commutate of lambda 1 with lambda 2, you'll get 2 times I lambda 3, which tells us that F 1, 2, 3 is equal to 1. Okay? So it's easy to see that they satisfy that commutation relation. Yeah. Okay. Excuse me. All right. Okay, so here's our model. But in fact, the coupling between the quarks here is given by the product of the lambda matrices. So we're going to figure this out in terms of not the lambda matrices themselves, but the basic states. So these gluons which we can interact, which we exchange, they could be of a red A bar B, i.e. red bar times green, or red bar times blue, A bar C, and so on. And the various possibilities, the diagonal ones are A dagger A minus B dagger B divided by the square root of 2, A dagger A bar A, B bar B, and minus 2 C bar C. So the last one, which is the totally singlet one, is removed because this is the group SU3 and not the group U3. Okay, so let's look at the coupling between a C and a C. So the only one which is diagonal in the C's is this coupling here. So we get minus 2 over the square root of 6 upstairs and minus 2 over the square root of 6 downstairs. So overall we get 2 over 3 as the interaction probability for these two. In the case where we're looking at the interaction of a C with a B, we have two possible interactions. We can have this one here coupling to this one here, so we get minus 2 over the square root of 6 from here, plus 1 over the square root of 6 from here, which is minus 1/3. And the other possibility is we exchange a B bar C gluon, which is this one here, and that gives us a sum of 1. So when we work it out, we can see that depending on the permutation symmetry of these guys, the probability of interaction is given in the case where you have a symmetric state just by a 2/3. So p equals 1, then the probability is 2/3. And if p equals minus 1, we get this one minus this one, which is minus 4/3. So overall, what we've done is we've calculated what the product of these matrices are equal to, summing over all A, in terms of this physical basis. And what we found are the two numbers, 2/3 and minus 4/3. Okay, so this is the interaction between two quarks. Now we want to look at interactions in terms of the various representations of the group we could form. So for example, if we put the quarks in a totally anti-symmetric representation, these guys here are called a Young tableau. Don't worry about them if you don't know what they are. We can talk about them maybe in the discussion. But anyway, these guys here, this is the quarks in a totally anti-symmetric representation. So what we have is we have three quarks. And remember, p is equal to minus 1, they're anti-symmetric. And so we get minus 1, minus 1/3, minus 4/3, times 3, because there are three pairs. And so we get minus 4 here. If we look at all the other representations, using the same rule, deciding what to... So these guys here, for example, are totally symmetric. So this corresponds to 3 times 1 minus 3 minus 1/3 is equal to 2. So this one here has an energy of 2, and this one here has an energy of minus 4. So if you go through the algebra in this table, what you'll find is that the lowest lying one is the singlet state. So the singlet state is attractive, whereas is the lowest lying, and all the others have a higher energy. That's not a proof in any way that the color singlets are the lowest lying states, because QCD is at low energy, certainly not modeled by one gluon exchange. But it is suggestive, the color algebra suggests, the lowest lying state is in fact the color singlet. So this one here is the one which is totally anti-symmetric in the three quarks. That's the color singlet. Okay? So, are there any questions on that? Yes? Okay, so what we're trying to show is that it's plausible that the singlet state is the lowest lying state of interaction of three quarks. If you have three quarks, you can put them into various representations. They could be in a singlet, they could be in an octet, they can be a decuplet, and so on, in terms of color. Okay? So what we're saying is that this simple argument to do with one gluon exchange suggests that the singlet will be the lowest lying state. Okay? So that's why it's plausible to even suggest that the color algebra tells us something, that the singlets are the only stable. So in fact, in reality, what we find is that since we've only observed color singlet states, Everyone else is separated by an infinite mass gap, so these guys are never observed at all. Okay? All right. Okay. Okay, it's sort of interesting to see what this model tells us about higher states. So here, for example, is a band state of 6 quarks, all in a color singlet state, and that is the deuteron, and that has the same energy. So this simple model is unable to tell us whether the deuteron is bound or not. All right. Okay, so let's talk about the Lagrangian of QCD. So we've decided that we have a color degree of freedom which has 3 colors. We've decided that that color degree of freedom, it's plausible that it belongs to an SU3 group. And so now we want to understand what the interaction of quarks and vector gluons in such a theory would be. Okay. So what it would be is we start out with the Lagrangian density. The Lagrangian density is given by a term, F alpha beta. So F is the field strength tensor, just like the field strength tensor in electrodynamics, which is made up of E fields and B fields. So the field strength tensor, that's the first term. And then we have a term involving the quarks coupled together through the covariant derivative. Covariant derivative expresses the coupling of the quarks to the gluons. Okay, and then in principle, in a interacting theory, we have a gauge fixing term, which we'll talk about later. So what about this field strength? The field strength is made up of the vector potential. So the vector potential, just like in electrodynamics, the derivatives of the vector potential tell us the E fields and the B fields. Okay, but the vector potential here comes in 8 different colors. So we saw in the SU3 group, we had 8 different gluons corresponding to red, anti-green, and so on. And so with the 8 of this, so this index A runs from 1 to 8. Alpha and beta, the Lorentz indices, which run from 0 to 3. And so we have the term which is familiar from electrodynamics. But in addition, we have a third term. The third term is the interacting term, which depends on the structure constants of the group. Remember, we talked about the structure constants of the group over here. And is bilinear in the gluon fields. So these indices run from over the 8 color degrees of freedom. And this third non-abelian term, this term here, is the term which makes QCD so different from QED. So QCD is developed in analogy with QED, but it's different in some very significant ways. And in fact, it's this term here which is responsible for the gluon self-interactions and ultimately for the property of asymptotic freedom, which we'll talk about later. Now, what about the coupling strength? The coupling strength is g squared over 4 pi, just like alpha electromagnetic in our units is e squared over 4 pi. The numbers are the structure constants of the group, SU through color group, which we talked about, and the quark fields are in a triplet color representation. So the quarks are in 3 colors, the gluons are in 8 colors. And so the covariant derivative, which is in the Lagrangian, is given here. It's a product of an ordinary derivative plus I times G times the gluon field. Okay, so acting the covariant derivative acting on a triplet field is given here, and it has an alternative form when it's acting on an octet or a joint field. Okay, so the T's, I'm sorry about this notational business, but the T's are actually half the lambdas which we introduced before. And the T's satisfy the simple SU3 algebra, and in the adjoint representation, they separate this. They satisfy the same algebra. And the metric is the West Coast metric, if you like, 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1, and the trace of the T's is equal to a half. Okay, so we've done a bit of exercises with this current algebra. So when you sum over A with this, the algebra of these T matrices, you sum over these A's, you get something which is CF. CF is equal to 4/3 for SU3. And this was the sort of crossing relation that we motivated in the case of the one gluon exchange. That's exactly the sort of thing which we derived by physical motivation. So you can work that out on your own. OK. Okay, so the great property about the QCD Lagrange is the property of gauge invariance. So the gauge invariance, what it tells you is you take a field, and at any point in space and time, you rotate it, perform an SU3 rotation, change the direction of that in space, at every different point in space and time. It makes no difference if you choose that what choice you make. So you're free to make a completely different choice of the phase or the direction in SU3 space of the field by performing such a rotation, and you'll still have the same theory. And the covariant derivative is so-called because it transforms in the same way as the field itself. So just like the field transformed to omega times Q, so does the covariant derivative under exchange gauge transformations transforms to omega times d alpha Q. So how do we show, what does this mean? What does this mean for the field A, for example? How does A transform under a gauge transformation? Well, if the covariant derivative transforms like this, we know that d prime q prime is equal to the covariant derivative, which is just the normal derivative, plus the A prime field, that's the expression of d prime, times the gauge transformation times the field q. So d acts on omega, and we get this first term here, then D will act on the quark field, and we get the second term, and then we get this A prime term. So in order that this condition is satisfied, it tells that the A prime field has to transform like this. It's equal to omega T dot A, omega to the minus 1, plus the term coming from here, which is D alpha omega to the minus 1. So the field transforms under a gauge transformation. And indeed, also the field strength tensor transforms under a gauge transformation. So that's a difference with QED. QED, the field strength tensor, is invariant under gauge transformations. Here, because of the color algebra, we find that the field strength tensor, in fact, transforms like as shown there, omega F, omega to the minus 1. Okay, so The QCD Lagrangian is gauge invariant. That is, we can rotate the fields by an arbitrary SU3 rotation at every point in the matter fields, at every point in space and time. It will make no difference to the theory. However, we cannot give the gluon a mass. So a term such as m squared times the product of the gluon fields is not acceptable. It's not gauge invariant, and that's exactly the same as in QED, where the mass of the photon would not be gauge invariant. Okay, so we have a Lagrangian here. And what we want to do is we want to use that Lagrangian. In particular, we want to use this Lagrangian in perturbation theory, in the limit in which the coupling constant is small. So in order to do that, we have to derive some Feynman rules. And the way we do that is we derive the Feynman rules by starting off with... we start off with the field strength tensor. Term involving the field strength tensor. And so this, if we set the limit g goes to 0, because we want to do perturbation theory, we're going to end up with del mu a nu minus del nu a mu. And then the same thing again. Times minus a quarter. And so if we take the Fourier transform of this, what we find is that we get something which looks like this. A nu, with some constant at the front, which I won't specify for the moment. Okay? So that's the term. So this would be the inverse of the propagator for the gluon field. So the interesting thing about this matrix here is it's a singular matrix, right? That is, if you try and diagonalize the matrix, you'll find that one of the eigenvalues is equal to 0. Which eigenvalue is equal to 0? Well, it's pretty clear what the eigenvector is. So if we take this matrix gamma nu and we contract it with p nu, we're going to get to 0. So this is the eigenvector which corresponds to a 0 eigenvalue for this matrix here. So if you have a singular matrix, you can't perform its inverse. And exactly what we want to do in order to derive the propagator is we want to get the inverse. So what's gone wrong is that, in fact, we have all these extra degrees of freedom, which are just pure gauge pieces. That is, that are of the order of del nu times lambda. And in Fourier transform, that becomes just equal to p nu. So all these terms have to be removed somehow, because they're extra degrees of freedom, which have no physical effect. And the way we do that is by introducing a gauge fixing parameter. And the gauge fixing parameter has the effect of changing this into this thing here, times thing here. Okay? So the gauge fixing term is shown there. This is the form of the gauge fixing term. And when we do that, our inverse propagator, instead of the thing which we had before, which was this, we get this extra term, 1 over lambda. So in fact, it's clear that without the gauge fixing term, this function would have no inverse, because it has a zero eigenvalue. Okay, so let's just figure out what the inverse of this function is. So if we take this guy here, and we multiply it by the known form of the propagator, so this would be minus g nu lambda plus 1 minus lambda p nu p lambda over p squared, all over 1 over p squared. When we multiply this out, what we should find is that this is equal to, going to be equal to g mu lambda. Okay? So there's an exercise for you. You see that what will happen is that this first term will give you the term that you want here, and all the other terms will cancel. So this one times this one, and then the cross term here will all cancel independently, and so you just get the inverse propagator. So that gives us the first of our Feynman rules for the propagation of a gluon. So the propagator for the gluon is given there, minus g alpha beta plus 1 minus lambda p alpha p beta 1 over p squared. And the I epsilon is put in for causality just in the same way as in QED. Okay, so here we have, this is the propagator, the corresponding propagator for the quark field, just like in electrodynamics. This is the three gluon vertex, which is the important one, which gives us the property of asymptotic freedom, the four gluon vertex, and then we have interactions with ghosts, which I'm not going to talk about, and interactions with quarks. So you can derive all of these rules in the same way. So the gauge fixing explicitly breaks the gauge invariance. However, in the end, the physical results will be independent of the way in which you break the gauge invariance, the choice of gauge. And for convenience, we normally choose lambda to be equal to 1, because lambda equals 1 will give us a simpler form. Instead of having three terms, we'll just have one term in the gluon propagator. So that's a good way to simplify. The ghost term, which I'm not going to talk about in detail, has the role of cancelling unphysical degrees of freedom, which would otherwise propagate in a covariant gauge. Yeah. So the I epsilon basically gives us a way of specifying how we're going to handle the region around p squared equals 0. And the I epsilon tells us that if we have states of positive energy, those guys will propagate forward in time. So it's demanded by causality. But basically, it's the prescription by which we deal with the pole at p squared of 0. Okay. All right, let's do a little exercise to figure out how to derive these Feynman rules. Tony, when did I start? Okay. All right. So let's do a little exercise to figure out Feynman rules. You see, when you're doing a calculation in the gauge theory, the signs are all important. They're a real devil. So you have to get the signs right. So let's just start off and try and get the signs right, at least for the propagators and the interactions. Okay? So how does that work? How does that work? let's imagine that we have some theory, and the action, let's say it's a charge scalar theory. It has a Lagrangian an action, so the action is equal to I times the integral of the Lagrange. Okay? So here's the action. And it has two terms. Okay? And so what I want to show you is that the propagators are the inverse of minus S, and the interactions are obtained from S. Okay, so let's do this in two particular ways. Okay? So the first student, who's pretty smart, says, well, I want to find out what the propagator is for this Lagrangian density. So what I'm going to do is take my rule that the propagators come from minus S, and I'll just write it down. I know that the propagator for this guy has to be minus 1 over k plus k prime. So it's the inverse of minus S. Okay? So the second student, who's diligent but perhaps not as smart, says, okay, I'm going to take k as my propagator. So the propagator for him is given by minus k, and the interaction is given by k primed. So what we want to do is we want to calculate the result of infinitely many insertions of k prime. So we start off with minus 1 over k, and then the next term is minus 1 over k times k primed minus 1 over k, and so on. Okay? And so if we sum up this geometric series, you'll find that it's just exactly equal to minus 1 over k plus k prime. So here we've inserted this interaction infinitely many times. We've got the same result as we must. Okay? So that tells you that this rule where the propagators come from minus s and the interactions come from s is the fact that it's done on the slide here. Let's skip the alternative choice of gauge. Let's talk about the running coupling. So we started out the lecture by talking about Re plus E minus. Were there any questions on fine points? Okay, we started off the lecture by talking about a quantity R. So now I want to talk more in detail about this cross-section Re plus E minus. And I want to talk about Re plus E minus in the context of perturbation. Okay, so we calculate this dimensionless quantity, okay? And we're going to look at this quantity in a limit, so the quantity R has no dimensions, and we're going to look at it in a limit in which we can ignore all the masses. So we set all the masses to zero. So you'd say a dimensionless quantity, it depends on dimensionless couplings, so it's a dimensionless quantity. There are no quantities carrying the dimensions of mass in there. So this quantity, apart from the overall scale of Q, so this quantity depends only on one mass scale, which we call Q. The masses we've set equal to zero. So this, since it's dimensionless, it must be independent of Q. Okay? So that's a simple argument. You say this function, it has no dimensions. It can only depend on Q. So then it must be a dimensionless. Unfortunately, that argument is not correct in a normalizable field theory, because in a normalizable field theory, in order to specify the scale at which you perform the subtractions, you make the theory finite, you have to introduce a secondary scale, mu. However, when you go down to the shop to buy your QCD Lagrangian, nobody tells you what the scale mu is. The scale mu is completely up to you, right? You can choose to normalize your theory at mu equals to the mass of the moon, and you still get the same result. What that means is that formally, if you take variations with respect to mu, those variations have to be equal to zero. Okay, so that's what's written here. We have a dimensionless quantity. In principle, it only depends on Q, but because we're calculating in a normalizable field theory, we have to introduce another scale, mu. But the dependence on mu is entirely arbitrary. You can choose any mu you like, and since you can choose any mu you like, the physical prediction must be invariant under changes of mu. So here, for convenience, we just take the logarithmic derivative with respect to the scale mu, and that's equal to zero. Okay, so mu is completely arbitrary, and if we hold the bare coupling fixed, R cannot depend on mu. So since R is dimensionless, it can only depend on the relationship, the ratio of Q squared over mu squared, and the renormalized coupling. Okay? So just for convenience, let's introduce the quantity tau. So tau is equal to the log of Q squared over mu squared. Okay? And then let's call beta of alpha s the logarithmic derivative with respect to mu squared. That's a fixed pair coupling, actually. Okay, so here we have our two quantities. And so our overall independence of mu turns into a simpler equation, which just said minus tau d by d tau beta of alpha s d by d alpha s r is equal to zero. So that's just rewriting our mu independence formula to make it easier to solve. Okay? Now the solution to this equation is introduced, we introduce an auxiliary quantity which we call the running coupling, and the running coupling is implicitly defined by this equation. Okay, so here, this is the quantity we're defining. Tau, we know what it is. It's the log of Q squared over mu squared. Alpha S of mu is some starting scale. Alpha S of Q is a running coupling. So this is the coupling at the renormalized scale mu, and this is alpha S of Q, which is the quantity we're introducing implicitly by this equation. Okay, so let's take the derivative of this guy here with respect to tau. So on the left-hand side, we get 1. And the right-hand side, we get d alpha s of q by d tau. D tau. So we're taking the derivative with respect to the upper limit, and then the value of the integrand at that upper limit. Now let's take the derivative of this equation with respect to alpha s of mu. So we get 0 on the left-hand side. Tau is independent of that. And then we get d alpha s of q by d alpha s times the value of the integrand at the upper limit, 1 over beta alpha s of q, minus the derivative of this with respect to itself, alpha s, which gives us 1, times the value of the integrand at the lower limit of integration, which is 1 over beta alpha s. Okay? So overall, we see that d alpha s of q by d alpha s is equal to beta of alpha s over beta of alpha s of q. Okay? So here it's pretty easy to see So what we want to do is we want to look at whether minus d by d tau plus beta of alpha s d by d alpha s r of alpha s and q and 1 is in fact a solution of this equation. Okay? So it's pretty easy with these auxiliary results to see that in fact it is. So if we take this first term, we know that d alpha s of q by d tau is given by beta alpha s of q. So this first term just gives us minus beta alpha s of q. The second term gives us beta of alpha s times d alpha s of q by d alpha s, which was just beta of alpha s of beta of alpha s of q over beta of alpha s. Did I get that upside down? It must be upside down. So this is, gives us beta alpha s of q by beta of alpha s times r primed. It's equal to 0. Okay. So this shows us that if you introduce the running coupling implicitly by this equation, then the solution to this equation, our mu independence equation, is R of 1 in alpha S of Q. So all the scale dependence on this function R comes through the running of alpha S of Q. Now, in the next slides, few slides, we're going to see that QCD is, in fact, an asymptotically free theory. What that means is that as Q goes to infinity, alpha S of Q goes to 0. So for large Q, we can use perturbation theory. So a knowledge of R at some point, an alpha S, allows us to predict the variation of R with Q. Okay, so this is the concept of the running coupling. It's introduced to this equation here. And it provides a solution of the normalization group. Okay, are there any comments there? Questions on the running coupling?
Can you say how the beta function relates to the original group theory?
So the beta function is defined. So we started off, remember, we introduced this thing beta. And the beta is, this is the coupling, the dependence of the renormalized coupling on the scale mu, which is the renormalization scale, actually at fixed values of the bare coupling. Fixed bare coupling. So that's the definition of beta function. Okay, so we'll go on. We'll see a rather more physical definition of the beta function in the next slide. Okay. So, in 1973, Politzer, Gross, and Wilczek actually sat down and calculated what the beta function in a non-abelian gauge theory was. And to their great surprise, they found that the beta function was negative. And what we see is that the first coefficient of the beta function, the definition of the beta function, is in fact negative. So we get minus b alpha s squared. So this thing begins in order alpha s squared. And the coefficient B is equal to 11 times CA. CA is equal to 3. It's a Casimir operator of the group SU3. So 33 minus twice the number of flavors over 12 pi. Okay, so that's the lowest order coefficient of the beta function. And then after that, after 1973, people said, well, okay, Gross and Wilczek did the first term. Let's go on and calculate some more terms. So people calculated the two-loop term, and it's shown here in green, as a function of alpha s. And then the three-loop term and the four-loop term are also shown here as a function of alpha s. So the important thing here is that when you calculate the higher order terms, this is for a particular case of three light flavors, the higher order terms just confirm the behavior which we saw in leading order. So they confirm the fact that the thing is negative at the origin, and including the higher order terms, it becomes more negative. It would have been possible that when you calculate the higher order terms, that this green curve would have been on the other side and would have gone up something like this, and eventually, but it didn't. That's the way it was. Okay. So this fact that the beta function is negative around the origin, minus beta alpha n squared, is the property of asymptotic freedom. And that is what allows us to make predictions at high energy using quantum chromodynamics. If the theory were not asymptotically free, we couldn't use perturbation theory. If we couldn't use perturbation theory, we wouldn't know where to start. So it's important that this property of asymptotic freedom is something which is not just a whim. It doesn't depend on a particular scheme. And so if you look at the beta function, the behavior of the beta function, minus b alpha s squared plus 1 plus b primed alpha s, those first two terms, you keep those first two terms. Let's imagine we make a choice of different choice of scheme, right? We say instead of choosing alpha s, I'm going to use alpha s bar, which is related to alpha s by the following way. Alpha s bar 1 plus c alpha s bar. Okay, so if we perform such a change of scheme, it turns out that the equation for d alpha s bar and the equation for d alpha s are identical, i.e. these coefficients b and b primed are completely invariant under changes of scheme. So that's great, because you wouldn't want some fundamental property like asymptotic freedom to depend on some stupid choice of renormalization scheme. So the first two coefficients of beta and beta prime, i.e. this one here, the blue one, and the green one, are invariant under a scheme change. Okay, so why is the theory asymptotically free? What does it mean? Well, in some sense, it's clear what the opposite effect would mean, but it's not clear what asymptotic freedom means. Because in electrodynamics, you can imagine that if you have a photon which is looking at a charge, and the charge somehow polarizes the vacuum around it, it's only that when you have a high-energy photon that you see the full charge. Otherwise, it's screened by electron and positron pairs around it. So only at high Q squared do you see the full charge. What that means is in electrodynamics, the effective coupling which you see grows as the photon becomes more energetic, as you see more and more of it. Okay, so that would be screening. Here we're seeing the opposite effect, that the coupling becomes smaller as you look with higher resolution. And so that would be anti-screening. Now, it's hard to visualize, but remember that Maxwell taught us that electricity and magnetism are in fact manifestations of the same phenomenon. So for electric forces, all we see is this screening phenomenon, the polarizability of a... But for magnetic forces, we see two types of interactions. We see both diamagnetism and paramagnetism. So one of those corresponds to screening, and the other one corresponds to anti-screening. And in fact, you can actually evaluate the 33 minus twice the number of flavors using magnetic analogy. Okay, but for the moment, I want to just leave you with this, that roughly speaking, this quark loop diagram computes that it gives you the negative NF in the beta function. And the gluon loop gives you the positive CA contribution. The 33 comes from that gluon loop. So the property of asymptotic freedom is intimately related to the fact that the gluon itself carries charge. The photon, remember the photon is charged, it doesn't carry charge. But the gluon, it's a red anti-green, the gluon itself carries charge. Now what does roughly speaking mean? Roughly speaking means there are gauges in which you can calculate the full effect of the beta function using that diagram alone. Okay? But I'm not going to go into that. So in QED, the beta function would have the opposite sign. That would correspond to screening. So it's a 1/3 103 pi alpha s squared. And in fact, from the earlier slides, we saw that the alpha s of q by d tau is minus b alpha s squared 1 plus beta primed alpha s of q. Okay, so this is putting in the explicit form for the beta function which we had in the previous slides. What does that tell us about the coupling? Well, if you have the alpha s of tau equals minus b alpha s squared, then you can integrate that and you get d alpha s over alpha s squared equals b times tau, which tells us we're integrating from alpha s of mu to alpha s of q, then we get 1 over alpha s of q minus 1 over alpha s of mu is equal to b tau, or that 1 over alpha s of q is equal to 1 plus alpha s of mu b tau. So if we take the inverse here, this becomes alpha s of q, and this becomes 1 over. Okay? So this is tau. So what does this mean? It says that the behavior of the coupling constant predicted by QCD is that it should fall off as an inverse power of a logarithm, with a known coefficient. So this is the log of Q squared over mu squared. This is a known coefficient. Okay, in fact, there should be an alpha s mu up here. Okay? All right, so the behavior of the coupling constant falls off as 1 over log Q. All right, and in fact, we can do better. We can keep the second order term. So these were the two terms that we just derived. We keep the beta prime term, you get this expression here. And so you can easily solve that. Given any alpha s of mu, you can tell what the value of the coupling is at any other value, q, just by solving this equation, say, using Newton's method. So the important point is that alpha s of q, as q becomes large, as Q becomes large, tau becomes large, off S of Q falls off like 1 over the log of Q squared. Now this sign is crucial. If the sign here had been negative, then the coupling would have grown as Q became large. But it doesn't, because this sign is positive. So the sign, which discovered by Gross, Wilkes, and Politzer, is absolutely crucial. What have we actually done with all this running coupling? What is it about? What are we actually doing? Well, what you're doing, if you look at this expression here, one over bt, and you solve alpha s of q is equal to alpha s of mu, and then we can expand this out, 1 minus alpha s b tau plus alpha s b tau squared with some coefficient and so on. Okay, perform an expansion of this this denominator here. So we see that alpha s of q, by expressing things in terms of the running coupling, we have summed up terms which include a logarithm for every power of alpha s. So here we have alpha s times the log of q squared over mu squared, alpha s squared times the log of q squared over mu squared. So we've summed up a whole series of terms which depend on the log of q squared. So the running coupling automatically resums logarithms of q over mu squared in the running coupling. And the neglected terms, i.e. the terms proportional to b prime, the b prime terms would have alpha s times alpha s b tau prime tau to a power. Okay, so they would have one less power of log q squared for every power of alpha s. Okay, are there any questions on the running coupling? All right, so this is a great victory. We've discovered that QCD tells us that the coupling falls off as Q squared goes to infinity. But it doesn't tell us at what point, the theory itself doesn't tell at what point alpha S of Q becomes large. So here we have the coupling, which is falling off, and it's falling off like 1 power of log Q squared, like that, right? So here's alpha S of Q. And here's log q squared q. It's falling off like 1 over log q. And at a certain point, it's going to become large. It's going to be of order 1. Okay? The theory itself doesn't tell us that. Only experiment can tell us where the coupling becomes large. And the way we parameterize the point where it becomes large is to introduce this parameter lambda. So lambda, in essence, is a specification of the coupling, the constant of integration in this equation with a particular form. So here we specify that the log of q squared over lambda squared is equal to 1 over alpha s of q dx over beta of x. So if we solve this equation and we keep the leading term, we find that alpha s of q, as wanted, falls off like 1 over log q squared, and lambda squared tells us the point at which alpha s of q becomes large. So if q were equal to lambda, then alpha s would be actually equal to infinity. Okay? So lambda specifies the scale at which, and then we can go on and do the same thing in next leading order. And this is in fact the definition of the coupling in terms of the lambda, which is wanted by the part of the data group. Okay, but in fact, lambda's a little bit a tricky concept to deal with, because it depends on the number of active flavors. So active means the number whose mass is less than the scale you're looking at. So for example, at above 5 GeV, where the bottom quark is completely active, you would have 5 active flavors. Below 5 GeV, and above charm threshold and below the bottom threshold, you would have 4 flavors. Okay, so say from above b equals 5 up to 175, we should nf equals 5. However, lambda is a difficult concept because it's full of all these pitfalls to do with definitions and numbers of active and flavors and so on. But conceptually, it's extremely important because it specifies the scale at which the proton becomes mass. The proton gets its mass from the energy of the binding, and that energy of the binding is specified in terms of lambda. Okay, so the scale of the masses of the protons, neutrons, everything else we see, the stars, is given by lambda QCD. Now, not to denigrate Mr. Higgs, but people often say that Mr. Higgs is responsible for mass. It ain't true. Mrs. Higgs is responsible for a very small part of the mass. It's lambda QCD that gives the mass to the observed universe. It's the phenomenon of the fact that lambda is the scale, it's the fundamental scale. And the mass of the proton, the mass of the kaons, everything else is proportional to lambda QCD. So that's why I introduced it, not because it's technically useful, because it's conceptually fundamental. Okay, so what we know about Alpha S, well, here's a plot produced by Siggy Betke, who has more or less the world franchise on Alpha QCD, and this is from July of this year, and here we see measurements made in E plus E minus, in deep elastic scattering in green, in heavy quarkonium in purple, and then E plus E minus measurements, particularly at the Z mass, which is somewhere here. These are the measurements at the Z mass, these are the measurements above the Z mass. And you see, no one can argue with the fact that alpha S is falling off as Q gets bigger. Okay? There's simply no way that this measurement can be reconciled with this measurement. Not only that, we see that all the points, more or less, lie within the errors about this line. And so, according to Betke, the world average value of alpha S is 0.1184. plus or minus 0.0007. The exact number is not important. The important thing is alpha S is extremely well determined. It's better than 1%. So alpha S is really well known, and the evidence that alpha S of Q falls off as predicted by the theory is quite persuasive. Here's another compilation of results, showing results from E plus E minus, and also results from lattice QCD, which I haven't had a chance to talk about, which are one of the best, most precise measurements up at the second point. Okay. So I'm going to quit there. Let me just recap what we've gone through today. The color degree of freedom is motivated by two things, at least two things. One is the ratio RE plus E minus, which is observed, and the other one is baryon spectroscopy. QCD is a gauge theory, like electrodynamics, but it's a gauge theory which is based on an SU3 group with three colors of quarks and eight colors of gluons which interact. The renormalization of dimensionless observables depending on a single scale implies that the scale dependence enters through the running coupling. And so we can actually predict the behavior of those quantities using the theory. Lambda is a fundamental parameter of QCD, but its practical use is fraught with difficulties. It's better to use alpha S at the Z mass in order to specify the size of alpha S. So asymptotic freedom implies that some high-scale quantities can be calculated in perturbation theory, because as you go to high energies, alpha S is becoming smaller because it falls off like one per log. So if we're at high energy, we can use the fact that alpha S is small, perhaps of order 0.1, as we've seen, and we can calculate in perturbation theory. And so here's the value of alpha S. It's 0.118 in the five-flavor MS power renormalization scheme. So alpha S is small. Okay, that's it for today. Tomorrow we're going to go on. We're going to talk about more about the structure of the proton and jets and infrared safe quantities. So are there any questions now? Yeah. Right.
What I understood is that Higgs, when fermions interact with Higgs, then they get mass.
That's
so
right.
They actually make protons. So how is
right.
that making
Right. Okay, so the point is the following, that the mass of the quarks, the Higgs mechanism, gives mass to the vector bosons. That's its primary role. Its secondary role, it gives mass to the quarks and mass to the leptons. Nevertheless, that's sort of, if you like, it's an intellectually separate part of the Higgs mechanism. And if the Higgs mechanism just gave mass to the W's and something else gave mass to the fermions, I think we'd be happy with that. Nevertheless, as the standard model is written down, the Higgs mechanism gives mass to the interaction of a electron with a phi field, and this phi obtains a vacuum expectation value. So phi gets phi is equal to phi dagger. Phi is equal to its vacuum expectation value, and so the electron gets a mass. You get some term which is m e bar e, right? And m is determined by the value of this vacuum expectation value. But the point is, the mass of the quarks is extremely small. It's a fraction. It's a few MeV. So the mass of the up quark, the down quark, the order 5, 7 MeV or something. The mass of the proton is almost a GeV. Okay. So what I said is that Mr. Higgs can be responsible for these masses here, but the mass of the proton at large is to do with the mass of the field, the energy of the field. It comes from the field energy of QCD. Okay. So this is a tiny fraction of the mass of the proton, because the quark masses are, even in the massless limit, the proton would still have a mass. Yeah. It's certainly true that lambda QCD is indicative of the scale where alpha S becomes large, and that we agree on, right? Now, the question you're asking is, you're saying it's not well defined because... Lambda QCD, I haven't quite understood why you feel that... I gave you a definition of lambda QCD in terms of the beta function of the theory, which presumably... the beta function is perturbed, if that's correct. Right. So... you're worried that it's arbitrariness in the definition of lambda QCD because of the fact that the definition I gave you was perturbative and it's clearly not adequate in the region close to when Q is close to lambda. Yes, I mean it's the okay. So that's the sort of conceptual difficulty which you have with lambda QCD. But what I was trying to say was that there was a fundamental. It's fundamental in the sense that it gives a scale to the theory, right? It gives this. It expresses the scale of mass in the theory, and so that in that sense it's fundamental. But again, all these issues to do with exact definitions and that's why. And when we're talking perturbation theory, people don't use lambda QCD very much anymore. It's all much better to specify it in terms of the mass at high energy, some high energy point times, like the mass of the Z boson. Any more?
So isn't the surprising thing that actually the perturbative part does apply so well, and things like renormal ones and so on can be introduced, and actually you can, from the perturbative side, look at this non-perturbative part,
Well, yeah, there are attempts to extend this into the low Q region to deal with issues like that. But let's just leave it there like this for the moment.
The office.
sitting down in the office upstairs. The coffee's through this way. We'll try to reconvene back on schedule last week.